Today's sponsors, privacy.com/ring. Privacy.com is a totally free service that lets you buy anything online without having to give out your credit card number. You just take a couple of minutes to link your bank account to your privacy.com account. Then you create virtual credit card numbers that you can use anywhere, which are linked to your bank account. Create as many virtual cards as you want with the ability to delete them and set limits so that you're not charged without your consent. It's great for signing up for free trials without the fear of being charged. You're totally protected from hackers because you're not giving out your real credit card number and your virtual card is locked to one merchant. And their mobile app and desktop browser extension make it easy to manage your wallet of virtual cards and autofill your virtual card number at the click of a button when shopping online. You can get 100% free and unlimited access by going to privacy.com/ring. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. This week's podcast will be shortened because of technical difficulties. But today on the show, we've got two great interviews for you. The first one is with Russian and Ukrainian expert Sophie Pinkham, author of Black Square, Adventures in Post-Soviet Ukraine, about rising tensions between Ukraine and Russia. Also on the program, attorney Chris Paulos. He'll be here to discuss how U.S. military personnel and their families are seeking justice in a federal court this week against the Islamic Republic of Iran. A recent seizure of two Ukrainian gunboats and a tug in the Kerch Strait by the Russian border guard has put both countries on high alert, causing many to be concerned that a war between the countries may be heating up again. Here to discuss the diplomatic issues at stake, Russian and Ukrainian expert Sophie Pinkham, author of the book Black Square, Adventures in Post-Soviet Ukraine. So, Sophie, let's to put what's going on in terms of the tensions between Russia and Ukraine in context and why this is relevant to the United States. Let's start with the Ukrainian Revolution. That we are now, well, I guess, almost 5 years out from that revolution. Now, what's the significance of it? What was the relationship between Ukraine and Russia prior?
Well, Russia and Ukraine have had a pretty fraught and complex relationship ever since the end of the Soviet Union. Obviously, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union and had always had very strong ties, although in the Soviet period, there was a lot of repression of the Ukrainian language, of Ukrainian national identity, and so on. So it was by no means a happy relationship, but it was a very close relationship. And after the Soviet Union, there was a series of different leaders with sort of a variety of political views, which I won't go into, sort of closer or further from Russia, their next door neighbor. But then in winter of 2013, there emerged this huge street protest movement, which came to be called Maidan after the Central Square in Kiev. And to some extent, it was about breaking Ukraine off from Russia, sort of breaking off the ties that continued to bind Ukraine and Russia. To a very large extent, it was also a protest against the rampant corruption of the then president, Viktor Yanukovych, who did have pretty close ties to Russia, but who was also just enormously, enormously corrupt in general. But it became framed, especially in the Western media, as a pro-European, pro-Western revolution and protest movement. And it was adopted by the EU, or it was sort of met with a very warm welcome by the EU, partly because it seemed to affirm that European values were still compelling, that there were still states outside the EU that were desperate to join and be part of the European community and so on. But the reality on the ground was more complicated. There was a significant strain of far-right nationalism in the protests. And this very quickly led to the flight of Viktor Yanukovych, the president, to Russia, which was followed shortly after that by the annexation of Crimea by Russia. And Crimea is a peninsula which had a separate status. It wasn't integrated into the rest of Ukraine the way all the other regions, the oblasts, are, but it was part of Ukraine under international law. It was primarily Russian-speaking. But Russia annexed it, and shortly after that, there emerged this sort of quote-unquote separatist movement, which was certainly funded and supported to a significant extent by Russia in eastern Ukraine,
okay,
which led to a war which is still going.
All right. Well, let's just pause there, and we'll go back. But I want to just the implications of the revolution, and what does I mean? So the people can understand the various national interests that are involved here, and I guess to the extent that we can refer to the sort of the nationalist agendas of the EU, but from the Russian perspective, that they would have, and maybe I'm overstating things, a client state in Ukraine prior to 2014. Like, well, what were the implications? Are we talking about resources? Is it simply just a matter of national pride? What were the underpinnings of that relationship and the desire for Russia to maintain at least a significant amount of influence over Ukraine?
Well, there are many different types of underpinnings. On one level, there's the economic tie between Russia and Ukraine, which is extremely strong and extremely important, especially actually to the Ukrainian economy. And the Ukrainian economy has been devastated by the breaking of ties between Russia and Ukraine recently. But then there's also the linguistic relationship. Ukraine does have quite a lot of Russian speakers. It's a region that has traditionally been considered by Russians, and again, this has to do with the repression of the Ukrainian movement, but for better or worse, it's been traditionally considered by Russia to be sort of Little Russia. It's sometimes called the little brother to Russia. Russians still oftentimes think of Ukraine as a part of Russia. So there's an economic tie, there's a cultural tie, there's a linguistic tie, there's a historic tie. And I think there is a feeling that of all the things that Russia lost with the end of the Soviet Union, in that the loss of Ukraine was almost the most painful. You know, it was one of the biggest republics, it has a lot of mines, it's a very rich agricultural region. So it was a loss on many levels. And then, of course, there's just the fact that Ukraine is one of Russia's largest and most important neighbors, especially on sort of the western, on the eastern side. They have a very large shared border. And it's not surprising that a country as large as Russia is preoccupied with a large country that has close ties to it on many levels and borders it.
And right. And because of obviously our national politics, I would imagine, too, that from Putin's perspective, to be the guy who lost Ukraine is not necessarily what he wants for his legacy.
Yes, it would be an extremely bad look to completely lose Ukraine. And it would be because, you know, then there's also the question of the EU and NATO, and Russia sees itself, I would say not without some justification, as in this sort of epic struggle with the EU and NATO for many years now. They feel that they were completely betrayed by NATO expansion. They feel that the West is trying to encroach in their sphere of influence. They're very, very upset about NATO and the EU. You can't really overestimate how upset Russia is about that. So this Maidan Revolution was framed in Russia as sort of a conspiracy of the West against Russia. And Russia historically, also going back centuries, has been incredibly anxious, again, not without some justification, about its borders. And so anything that causes them to feel that their borders are being encroached upon causes immense anxiety and hostility.
Okay, and so we're now at 2014. The revolution has taken place. Yanukovych has left Ukraine for Russia. And Just okay, and I know this, you know, to a certain extent is a little bit annoying to reduce the geopolitics here to the you know how this impacts or affects Donald Trump, but just place for folks who want to contextualize Manafort, Paul Manafort's relationships here, just place Manafort in this circle, at least, you know, in the small quarters in which he operated and wanted to influence U.S. Policy.
I am a little bit, I'm certain that Manafort is an awful man and a criminal and so on. But I am a little skeptical about how much prominence Manafort has been given. I mean, Manafort was making a lot of money consulting for Yanukovych's people. Okay. And after the revolution, they went into Yanukovych's estate, I guess, and, you know, found a lot of documents about all the money that was being given to Manafort. He was, you know, he's like a corrupt political consultant going around consulting with corrupt dictators.
Well, fair enough.
I don't know how much that means.
Well, I don't know how much it means either. But I think for people who, you know, hear that Manafort had relations and was representing people in that region, he could very well have just been some barnacle who just saw a pot of money and was dipping into it, which is at the very least likely. But people, I just, you know, so the people, it's not a black hole for people when they hear about these relations. All right, so let's take a break here, when we come back, we're going to pick up at the beginning, essentially, of the war between Ukraine and Russia, coming out of the 2014 Ukrainian Revolution, where the client state relationship between Russia and Ukraine ends and has yet to been, in many respects, resolved, leading up to the latest incident, which has created tensions between Ukraine and Russia. We got to take a quick break. I'll be right back with more. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. So, Sophie, when we broke, you had basically walked us up the recent history of the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, at least until 2014, when there was a revolution and the Ukrainian leader Yanukovych fled Ukraine for Russia. Russia at that time then annexed Crimea. And was beginning to foment some separatist, I guess, aspirations within Ukraine. To what end?
I think the main goal was to destabilize Ukraine, to weaken Ukraine, to punish Ukraine, essentially. And it is important to know that it wasn't fully orchestrated by Russia. It was strongly supported by Russia and probably only succeeded because of Russian support. But Ukraine has a lot of issues of sort of regional divisions, which I won't go into now because they're very complicated. But anyway, Russia was supporting it, and they succeeded in destabilizing Ukraine. Ukraine is much weaker than it used to be. Ukraine is in a bad position. Ukraine's military was very weak when the separatist uprising began, and especially since the separatists had support at crucial moments from the Russians, they've been able to make it into probably sort of a frozen conflict, as you say, about places like Transnistria, which is a favored tactic of Russians in these contested areas. And so now there are two separatist so-called republics in eastern Ukraine, which maintain ties to Russia. And there's just been sort of a continuous simmering war going on since 2014.
When you have two regions that are separatist regions and they maintain ties with Russia, like what does that look like in practice?
Well, it looks very bad for the people who are stuck in those republics. It would be one thing if they got to be a part of Russia. I mean, being in Russia has a lot of problems. This holds true actually for Crimea also, I think. The situation for the Crimeans is very bad, and it's not as if they're now just Russian citizens living in Russia. You know, they're really isolated. They have all kinds of financial problems. They have problems with access to foods and medicines. There's really an ongoing humanitarian crisis in eastern Ukraine especially, which gets very little attention. So I think that life is pretty much a nightmare in those places. And Russia is interested in stirring up trouble, but of course they're not very interested in actually making life livable for the people in those regions. And meanwhile, there continue to be periodic skirmishes between Russia and Ukraine. So, or not Russia and Ukraine, the separatists in Ukraine, sometimes effectively Russia and Ukraine, but it's ostensibly the separatists in Ukraine. People are periodically killed and injured and so on.
So these areas are in many respects sort of orphaned, if you will. They're not receiving services from either Ukraine or Russia, and largely the people living there are pawns. Who are the, is that a function of you have separatist leaders who are who sit atop these separatist regions, and they have their own sort of like side deals with Russia? I mean, what would inspire them to orphan themselves?
Well, I mean, I think that it's people who are, you know, excited by power and violence. You can always find those sorts of people, and especially when arms are readily at hand, they're excited to sort of make themselves into warlords, practically. A lot of these people are like warlords when you see them. And they, of course, are, I think, getting funding and getting support from Russia, so they're living okay. But I think it also has to do with power and status.
Okay, and so, all right, so take us up to the most recent rise in tensions, or I guess I should say, before we get to that, situate for us where the United States is in this conflict, maybe not actually involved, but rather what is our ostensibly our disposition towards it and the EU's disposition. There are some in this country who think that the U.S. has been fomenting the, I guess, the Ukrainian separatist movement, I mean, or the Ukrainian nationalist movement, which, you know, has some elements of people whose ideologies wouldn't particularly appreciate. To what extent do you think that is true? And if it is or is not, what is the U.S. disposition towards Ukraine and its relationship with Russia?
I would say that the U.S. disposition has been pretty similar to the way the U.S. has behaved in relation to many former Soviet states that have started trying to resist Russian influence or break away from Russian influence. And that is that in terms of rhetoric, the U.S. is very supportive. And there's a certain amount of support, you know, from organizations like USAID and also oftentimes from non-governmental funders and things like that for democracy initiatives, for humanitarian initiatives, and so on. These are often viewed by Russia as conspiracies for an anti-Russian coup or what have you. In practice, apart from aid, they're not really offering that much support or protection. And I think it's actually a really unfortunate balance that has been struck with Ukraine and also with Georgia a few years back when Saakashvili was still president. It's almost as if the U.S. and also NATO and also the EU sort of lead these countries on and act as if they're willing to have them be members. And there are significant constituencies in these countries, especially in Ukraine, that wish they could be in the EU or who want to be in NATO and want to have that protection. I think that that is not a promise that will be fulfilled, probably, or should be fulfilled, but by publicly making statements of sort of fairly extravagant support for a country like Ukraine against Russia, the U.S. and also NATO and the EU really can really provoke Russia in a way that I would say is unnecessary and probably harmful in the long run for Ukraine.
It's almost the worst of both worlds in some ways.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be close enough to you to alienate you, to sour your relations with your neighbor. But not so much that we're actually going to help you in any way.
Exactly.
Okay. So take us up to the present day. We have new attentions. What is behind those?
Well, this last episode, which happened last week, was quite bizarre. What happened was that, the Ukrainians tried to get some ships to go through the Strait of Kerch, which is a strait where Crimea and Russia almost touch, and go into the Sea of Azov. And it's this complicated situation where, according to the treaties that still exist, the legal treaties, Ukraine should be able to sail in and out of there freely. But in practice, because of the Russian annexation of Crimea, it's much more Russian-controlled area than it used to be. And so, realistically, Ukraine should have alerted the Russians to the fact that they wanted to sail through and gotten permission in advance. But they decided not to do this, probably as some kind of statement or gesture or perhaps desire to provoke a conflict. And sure enough, the Russian ships that were there rammed the Ukrainian ships, fired on them, and seized the ships and also the people who were in them. And three people were injured. No one was killed. And the damage, I think, to the ships was not massive. So it was a pretty performative episode in a lot of ways. And the Ukrainians quickly started trying to present this as just an act of Russian aggression against Ukraine.
So what is the big danger that something comes out of this? Just increased hostilities?
Well, the first big danger is that Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, who's insanely unpopular, has declared martial law in large swaths of Ukraine, which is really bizarre and incomprehensible, and seems like it has to do with the fact that he's facing an election in March, which he's almost certain to lose. So there's the consequences for democracy in Ukraine. And then there's also the possibility of this being used to sort of bait the U.S. or NATO into further escalating confrontation with Russia, which I think is unnecessary and dangerous.
Sophie Pinkham, thank you so much for your time today. Fascinating stuff. And I think people have a much better sense of something that we hear only almost like peripherally in our news. Thank you again.
Thank you, Sam. It was great to talk to you.
Sophie Pinkham is a writer and academic specializing in Russian and Ukrainian culture and politics. Her book, Black Square, Adventures in Post-Soviet Ukraine, is available on her website, sophiepinkham.com, or wherever books are sold. Folks, justcoffee.coop is having a 30% off trial this week on all its coffee, tea, or chocolate. Check it out. If you ever wanted to try justcoffee.coop coffee, now is the time. They've got a Majority Report blend. I'll even talk about the WTF blend that they have in support of Marc Maron. But be that as it may, go check out justcoffee.coop. I know you've always wanted to try that coffee. This week only, you can try it with 30% off. No coupon code necessary. Check it out. Joining us now is Chris Palos, an attorney, to tell us about legal hearings earlier this week in a federal court regarding U.S. service personnel and their families who have been killed or maimed in Iraq due to terrorist activities funded by the Iranian government. All right. So, Chris, I know that there is a hearing this week, but before we get to the hearing, back us up a little bit. Tell us what is the genesis of the case, and who are the plaintiffs, and under what auspices can these plaintiffs, or is it your theory that the plaintiffs can bring a case?
Okay, so the case, the hearing that's occurring this week in the District Court of Washington, D.C., is related to a case called Karcher versus the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the case involves U.S. service members and civilian contractors who were injured or killed in Iraq by Iranian-sponsored terror groups using weapons and other material support provided by Iran in order to do just that, to commit terrorism in Iraq and destabilize the coalition efforts to create a free and democratic Iraq. That's happened, obviously, between 2003 and up through 2011. And the cases had started to get filed sometime in about late 2014 and 2015, and have been subsequently filed since then, especially now as information is being declassified, as more information is coming to light and is being released by the Department of Defense and the government and other foreign governments about Iran's malign influence in Iraq while the coalition forces were there, and what it was doing specifically to murder, kidnap, and maim American service members, coalition members, and also civilians in Iraq that held different beliefs and ideologies than the Shia leaders of Iran. So this case involves several hundred plaintiffs, service members, like I said, who are suing the country of Iran for particular types of attacks that they were injured or that their family members were injured in. And the hearing that's happening this week is the liability hearing. There is affirmative evidence being put on related to Iran's control of these groups in Iraq, their material support and this precise methods that they used in order to essentially wage a undeclared war, a campaign of terror against the United States or anybody else that they felt they did not want to have in Iraq at that time.
So backing up here, I mean, I think like the general reaction to this by most people is just an unawareness or lack of awareness that you can sue another country essentially for waging a war. The United States, obviously, not the military personnel, but I guess they're under the auspices of the U.S. government, made a an active choice to go and invade Iraq, presumably aware that there would be forces there that would be fighting against them. I mean, under what auspices can military personnel sue a foreign government? I mean, it seems like it's almost just as likely that they would sue the U.S. government.
Well, there's a very important distinction between what Iran was doing in Iraq and how it was targeting not just military members of the coalition forces, but civilians as well. And there's a great distinction between actual war as it's defined legally and an act of terrorism. And as surmised, suing a foreign government is usually out of bounds. There's a concept called foreign sovereignty immunity. And there's many treaties across the globe that governments have signed not to allow their citizens or even their own governments to sue other sovereign nations. However, the U.S. has a law called the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act that sets forth the grounds for sovereign immunity for foreign governments and dignitaries. And there's exceptions to that immunity. And those exceptions include terrorist acts and terrorism, including extrajudicial killings, kidnappings, and torture. So if a foreign government, its agent, instrumentality, or its representatives commits an act that falls under one of the exceptions, then that opens up the opportunity to bring a lawsuit under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act for the conduct that is not accepted or that is considered to allow for subject matter jurisdiction against that defendant or that entity. And that's what this is. That essentially, we went to war with Iraq. We went to a war against Saddam Hussein. We went into that country to dispose of that dictator and to attempt to set up a democratic government using a coalition force. We did not go to war against Iran. Iran has never openly declared war against the United States, nor has the United States declared war against Iran. What Iran did is it used terrorist proxies such as Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, fed them money, personnel, weapons, and training, and ordered and approved of them killing and attacking Americans and civilians indiscriminately. They would plant roadside bombs, send suicide bombers into mosques and into markets, and it didn't matter if they were killing civilians or American soldiers, as long as they were creating a destabilized environment while the Americans were at that time.
All right. Well, so let's just back up just another step and give us, in the context of this case, but generally speaking, what are the elements that the plaintiffs will have to prove in order to get a judgment from the court? I mean, you say currently there's a liability hearing. What are the other elements and what do we mean by liability?
Okay. Well, there's essentially, in order to prove that a state actor or entity that's controlled by a state is responsible for committing terrorism or materially supporting terrorism, first of all, only American citizens at this point can bring a claim using the United States Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act against a foreign government for terrorist acts that occurred extraterritorial outside of the United States. And they have to prove to the court's satisfaction using evidence of how that defendant participated in the act leading up to their injuries, in the terrorist attack in which they were injured or killed. And you can be held, or a state sponsor of terror can be held liable for their sponsorship of terror if they provided material support. And that comes in many forms. They don't actually have to be the ones that planted the bomb or lit the fuse or pulled the trigger, but they had to have supported those who did. And Iran is the world's most notorious state sponsor of terror, and their main proxy is Hezbollah. And the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran has been well known for years, and it's firmly established that Iran uses Hezbollah outside of its own borders to essentially, as they term it, export the Iranian revolution in the form of terrorism. So a plaintiff essentially needs to be able to demonstrate that the attack that they were in was committed by individuals or groups who are materially supported by that state sponsor of terror. And that can come in various forms of evidence, depending on the type of terrorist attack that it is, and what types of information that are out there that are either publicly available, classified, or recently declassified information to support those connections.
Fascinating. Okay. All right. Well, let's take a break here. And when we do, I want to get back, now that you've sort of provided for us the structure of a case like this, want to start getting into what we know now that we didn't know 5-10 years ago that is encouraging U.S. service military personnel and perhaps others to bring actions against Iran for their terroristic acts. And I think the other question that most people might have is, how do people recover in this instance? We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Chris Paulos in just a moment. So, Chris, in the last segment, you basically walked us through the circumstances that allow for U.S. military personnel to sue a foreign country for, or their family, I guess, to sue a foreign country for wrongful death, wrongful injury. I presume are is the nature of the cases. You said that these cases are being brought under an exception to the U.S. Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, and essentially the plaintiff has to prove how the offending, the defendant, in this case a government, the state of Iran, how they participated. In this instance, it would be material support. So give us a sense of what the, if that's the outline, what is the theory that Iran supported Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda by giving them money, by giving them weapons? And does the support, are the plaintiffs obligated to draw a direct line between that support? In other words, if Iran says, well, we give money to Hezbollah and they're involved in actions that aren't in Iraq and weren't 10 years ago, and that's where the money went. The other money, you know, they raise some other way. How direct need be that material support?
Well, that is an excellent question. And it really boils down to what particular groups are involved in the attack. And by law, certain groups have been designated under the United States Treasury, the OFAC department. They will designate people for being narco-terrorists, and they have a special particular designation reserved for the worst of the worst, the most motley crew of terrorists out there, and it's called Foreign Terrorist Organization, FTO. And if somebody, whether it's a foreign government or not, it could even be a private corporation, but that falls under a different law in terms of civil liability. But if you deal with a FTO, a foreign terrorist organization, if you provide any form of material support that FTO uses to further its activities, even if it's mere humanitarian activities that FTO may be providing, what that does is, if you're putting a dollar in their left pocket, it frees up the dollar in their right pocket for them to use for their terroristic activities. And so the concept or the theory of liability relies on the fungibility of money. And so if you're dealing with an organization that has been deemed a foreign terrorist organization, any involvement with that organization could raise a risk and liability to you for providing material support to terrorism. So groups like Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, ISIS, those groups are designated foreign terrorist organizations, and mere support to those organizations gives immediate rise to liability for material support. And that's exactly what Iran has done. Iran has developed relationships, even with groups that are ideologically and religiously opposed to them, if they can meet some common ground. And in Iraq, the common ground was killing Americans and Westerners. Right. And so although Sunni and Shia ideologically have been opposed for hundreds or if not thousands of years, then they will come together. Iran will actually support Al-Qaeda, give Al-Qaeda money, give Al-Qaeda weapons, if strategically it's more advantageous for them to do so than to kill the Americans themselves. And that is exactly what they were doing in Iraq. Depending on the area of Iraq, where if it was Sunni controlled and it was predominantly Sunni, a Sunni area that held no import to Iran, they would arm and fund Sunni groups to attack Americans and other coalition forces in those areas. And if it was in a Shia area, they had their own special groups that were trained by Hezbollah and the IRGC Quds Force in sophisticated bomb-making skills, complex tactics, techniques, and procedures that they employed against coalition forces. And so certain attacks have telltale signs of Iranian involvement. And it wasn't clear that this Iranian involvement was occurring, but it began as soon as United States boots hit the ground in Iraq. Iran was ready to sow discord, to send money, to send foreign fighters, and to send other material support into Iraq to disrupt what the United States was aiming to do at the time it was there. It has come to light even more so over the last several years as declassified information has rolled out, including some of the documents and information that came from the raid on Osama bin Laden, in which Osama bin Laden talks about the importance of Iran's money to what Al-Qaeda is doing. Also, after 9/11, Iran provided safe haven to Al-Qaeda, from which Al-Qaeda leadership directed attacks against Americans from their safe soil in Iran. Now, Hezbollah, they had a much more active role on the ground in Iraq. And throughout our time over there, they would continually capture Farsi-speaking Iranians that were embedded with insurgent groups who, through interrogations, and through the Iraqi criminal court prosecutorial process, it was determined that they were actually enlisted military members of the IRGC that were coming back and forth through the porous border of Iran into Iraq to train groups of people to attack and kill Americans.
Okay, so if through and presumably what happens is I'm a plaintiff, I'm the family member of an army specialist who was killed in Baghdad. There is new evidence that he was killed, and I'm just speaking hypothetically, by an IED that was developed by a terror group that was funded by Iran. How do I anticipate collecting? Like, you know, assuming that I can prove this and I get a judgment, how do I collect against Iran?
Well, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act provides for enforcements of judgments. And up until recently, that could be very difficult for a country like Iran, particularly because it's been so isolated from the global economy, where normally you would seize assets, or if the defendant elects to appear in the case and defends itself, then presumably they would be responsible for any judgment that is entered against them. But if you have somebody like Iran who thumbs its nose at the U.S. judicial process and it refuses to participate in any proceedings that accuse it of terrorism, while at the same time it'll head off to New York or somewhere else to participate in intellectual property disputes and commercial disputes and trade disputes, it elects not to even acknowledge the victims of its terrorism that it commits by showing up in court to defend itself. So at that point in time, plaintiffs have an enforceable judgment if they prove their case to the court's satisfaction. at which they can begin to hunt down assets that belong to the Iranian state itself or to its agents and instrumentalities. However, the government, understanding that that many victims of especially Iranian terrorism have not been able to collect their judgments, has developed a process that creates a fund that is intended to compensate victims of terrorism who successfully obtain a judgment against a state sponsor of terror. That All fund right. has been in existence for a few years and is now starting to pay out money to victims of wow. terror who successfully prosecute their cases.
Well, Chris Paulos, we'll continue to follow this story. It's fascinating. I appreciate you filling us in on it.
Happy to be a part of the show, Sam. Thanks for the opportunity, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Chris Paulos is an attorney representing military personnel and family members killed or maimed in terrorist attacks funded by the Iranian government. You can learn more at levinlaw.com. That's this week's show. As always, you can check out ROFpodcast.com to support this program by becoming a member. It is your support that makes this show possible. We'll be back next week with a full show. Till then, thanks for listening. Hey folks, Sam Seder here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire Radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated.